Welcome to our Goals to podcast, where we take you behind the scenes with authors of many different writing styles. I'm Lucinda Hawksley. I do hope you enjoy this episode. If you want to find out more, go to www.goldster.co.uk and don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Goldster Conversation. I'm absolutely thrilled today to have with me someone who I think you might recognise, my co-presenter on the Goldster Book Club, Humphrey Hawksley. And I don't think you need any introduction, so I'm going to begin by asking you, tell us about when you ran away to sea.
Well, that has put me in the middle of it, hasn't it? Yes. Yes. Hello, everybody. Wonderful audience. Great to be here. And Lucinda has asked me what you call a curveball. So we sit down for hours planning these meetings, and she never told me about that one. Yes, I was brought up in an era that I think many of you here will be familiar with. It was in the sort of school at 60s, teenager in the early 70s. And the peer groups and heroes weren't exactly the same as we have now, because our heroes were Mick Jagger of the Rolling Stones and John Lennon of the Beatles. They weren't stock market billionaires. And at the time, my parents were getting divorced, as they tended to at that time. Their mind was on other things. And I was coming out of my A-levels, which I didn't do very good at. And I was asked to fill in I think it's called an UCA form to go to university. And the master at the school said that you haven't filled in your UCA form yet. And I said, what's it for? And he said, it's to go to university. And I said, what's that for? And he looked at me like a deer in headlights. And he couldn't actually answer it. And I thought, no, I can't do that. I want to go to Africa and Australia and Asia and that sort of thing, the hippie trail and all that. So I found a passage on a merchant ship and went to take it to Australia, age 17. I didn't actually leave until we were 18 because the engines kept breaking down, so we were stuck in Port Talbot in Wales for months.
So you had a great confidence in that ship before you even got onto it, as the engines kept breaking.
It was so big. I mean, you couldn't. Yeah, and I learned a lot. I mean, and my mother kept writing to me saying, Humphrey, your gap year is almost over. What are you going to do? And that went on for about five gap years. And that was it. That's why I ran away to sea.
And how did that lead you into journalism?
The travel at that age, I mean, I think when you're 17 or 18 or whatever, you don't make mistakes, do you? You just learn things. So I went to Angola and saw people walking on their heads on the sand. I went to Japan, where the Chinese bosun on the ship, it was a Hong Kong Chinese crew, refused to get off because he thought the Japanese would cut his head off. And of course, you didn't know. I sailed through the South China Sea, which I wrote a book about 50 years later. And I think that, and then the actual catalyst, Lucinda, was, I think it was the Christmas of 1974. I was in Darwin, which is in the far north of Australia, and I was planning to do the Asian Trail across. I'd hitchhiked up there, and I was working on building sites and things. And the town was blown down by Cyclone Tracy, flattened completely. People were killed and the rest of it, and we spent the night there making sure our house didn't fall down by leaning against the walls and then going in and out as the wind blew. And then over the next few days, there was a mass evacuation and journalists came into town and they would interview us and report. And they'd go, I thought, this isn't a bad job. You fly in, you get a little bit of fame, you write a story, and then you fly off to the next one. So I thought, I'll try that when I get back to England.
And so what was your first entry point into journalism? Who was the first person to take a chance on you and give you a job?
That was the basic. I worked for a magazine called Gifts International. And it was writing about onyx ashtrays for a trade magazine. And it was the winter of discontent. I suspect some of it, you're too young, far too young for this, but some of us might remember that. And I was paid enough, not enough to live on. And
Well, I've been there.
Yeah. And I just stuck with it because, and then I moved on to something called Printing World, which was much closer to that. And then I got a job on a local newspaper called the Congleton Chronicle. And that was where you actually learnt the trade, yeah, going to the funerals and the courts and the council meetings.
And so what do you think you learned from your local newspaper experience that took you on to your international career, which it became?
Local news, it's a little bit like a small group like this. When you're broadcasting to millions, that's fine. But here, anybody could pick me out for saying something that was wrong. So with the local newspapers, if you spelt a name wrong, if you got somebody's age wrong, they're going to be on to the editor straight away. So accuracy was a very big thing there. But I was too, I still wanted to be this Darwin foreign correspondent. So I actually got a job down in London with something called the Fleet Street News Agency. And that was an agency that did the stories that the Sun and the Mirror and the tabloids wouldn't do. So this was the totally extreme stories. We were meant to go into somebody's house where there'd been a fire and steal the photographs and publish them and all that sort of thing. But they were very, very sort of ruthless to us as well. And I came, at one stage, I had about 20 parking tickets and bald tires on my car, which I couldn't afford to fix. I said, oh, there's enough of that. And a friend of mine happened to be a racehorse transporter. So I rang him up and I said, I can't afford to live here anymore or do this job. And he said, well, come for half a day's training. We'll make you a racehorse handler and we'll fly you to Australia. So I did that and I went to Australia and I went down to Melbourne and I wrote in with cuttings from the Mail and the Standard and that to the thing. And the chief of staff rings up from the Melbourne Herald and said, oh, good day, Humphrey. We'd like to give you a job, but we don't know who you are, so you can only be a D-grade young apprentice journalist or whatever it was. And he said, we can only offer you so much. It was five times what I was getting in.
Did you hesitate a bit and play hardball? No,
I don't play hardball. If somebody offers me something, I take it. Bird in the bush, I say. But just to finish that, I went in the first day and I got the first byline on a story about some flood or something. And he comes back, he says, look, we're going to have to change your byline. And I said, well, he says, well, nobody's called Humphrey around here, so we're going to call you Jack Hawksley, all right? And that was my journalistic career.
So you began as Jack Hawksley.
Jack Hawksley. I was Jack, yes.
Brilliant. So when did you get your big break at the BBC? Because most people know you as your kind of from your time as foreign correspondent for the BBC. How did that happen?
I went up to Hong Kong to work on the South China Morning Post up there, actually, and then back here. And I started shift work on the BBC. There was no silver spoon or anything like that. And then they eventually took me on. This was as a sub-editor in the main BH newsroom, they call it. There was BH, which was the domestic news, does the 1800, but 6 p.m. news and that sort of thing. We worked on that. And then they had Bush House, which was the World Service. And they were very different culturally. So I worked in the BH newsroom for several years. It was
Broadcasting House.
Broadcasting House, yes. And then I moved to Bush, and that's when I got my first assignment as a foreign correspondent to Sri Lanka, which I got thrown out.
Tell us about getting thrown out of Sri Lanka. What happened?
That was the beginning of the Tamil Civil War. I'm not sure how many of you might remember that, but they had a 25-year civil war there. And at the time, the government, which was Sinhalese. There are two ethnic races. There's the Tamils and there's the Sinhalese. And the Sinhalese ran the government and they were massacring basically the Tamils up in the north. And we've had much of this since then in the Balkans and other places like that. People tend to do that sort of thing. And I was reporting that and the government didn't like it and threw me out. at the what was interesting at the end of that sort of 20-year cycle, it was the Tamil Tiger terrorists that actually became the most brutal, well-organized terror group in the world. They invented the suicide vest, and they did the child soldiers and all that sort of thing. So, you know, I was backing them, but they turned out to be the bad guys.
Oh, no. Have you been back to Sri Lanka since you got ejected?
I have a few times, but I'm not sure I'd want to go again.
Do you go as Jack, not Humphrey?
I was Humphrey then. The BBC liked me being Humphrey, yes.
So after Sri Lanka, where did you move on to?
Sri Lanka, then back, then the Philippines. If anybody remembers Imelda Marcus's mm-hmm. 2000 Pairs of Shoes,
yep.
It was in that era. And that taught me a little bit about this democracy authoritarian thing that we hear in the newspapers now, because the Philippines had been a dictatorship. Marcos was overthrown. I covered in just 18 months, there were about 5 coup d'etats where the military was trying to take back control again. And when I talked to the soldiers that were doing it and the people that were backing it, they told me that they didn't understand what they called the democratic space. They were used to a society where a man says, or the government says something, and it gets done. And they couldn't understand this opposition thing. And it's stayed with me. And it's been in my, when we even, you know, here we talk about there's too much debate about things. Why can't we just do things?
Yeah.
And that thought has stayed with me. So that was the Philippines. And then I went to Hong Kong after that.
And you were in Hong Kong for quite a few years, weren't you?
Hong Kong and then Beijing, mm-hmm. yes.
So tell us about those years. About those years in Hong Kong and Beijing.
Well, Hong Kong was... I went to Hong Kong because they had the Tiananmen Square massacre in 1989. I think I went there in 1990. And it was really, we were coming up to the handover of Hong Kong. And it was a very interesting story that I only half understood because Chris Patten came out as the governor. He had lost his seat in the 92 election. He came out as the governor. And he then started sort of putting in all these supposed safeguards and democracy elements for the people of Hong Kong, knowing that he couldn't stay there, you know, knowing that he would be kicked out. And what I hadn't realized as I was doing that reporting is that Chris, who became a good friend actually, was actually doing it for the British Parliament and for British press, because there wasn't a Chinese press to reflect it. And of course, as soon as he left, they unwound it all. And those who follow it, they've now got a national security law, and there's and friends of mine actually who were there are in Hong Kong jails at the moment and have been for a long time.
Wow. So had you stayed, do you think you could have ended up in a jail?
No, I would have been thrown out.
Right.
And a couple of friends of mine who were longtime English residence correspondents there just left, and they're here now.
Well, we're going to come back later to some of your campaigning and journalism work, but I really want to talk about your fiction as well. So I'm going to ask you about this book. This is Dragon Strike. This came out, I think, in the late 90s.
Yes.
Is that right?
97, yes.
Tell us about this.
That was my first book that I ever published. And I was then the Beijing correspondent. And I think we were around 95. And if you're a foreign correspondent in your late 30s or whatever I was then, you feel that you should get a book under your belt. It's just one of those things. So I'd written to an agent who'd taken me on a number of very worthy things about whither China, whither the economy, whither the world. And at one visit to London, he said, Humphrey, I've got somebody I want you to meet about your book proposal. I was very excited. So I go into this office that's full of sort of posters and memorabilia, lots of military stuff. He was a military publisher. And it's the late William Armstrong, a wonderful man. And he looks at it. There's no computers. That's to say, he's got a piece of paper. He looks at it as I walk in, and then he pushes it like that. And it gets caught in the wind and ends up in the waste paper basket. And I thought, why am I here? And he says, oh, this is all very worthy. Yes, it's nicely written. I could sell maybe 500 copies of a book if you do that. And I thought, time to leave. You should talk about, you know, push back again. And then he leans forward and he says, but tell me, could you write me a book about America going to war with China? And I thought, goodness, yes, because I'm a journalist. I'm a hack journalist. I'll do whatever the editor wants. So I said, yes, I'll do it. And that began, I wrote it with a Financial Times correspondent because they wanted it like yesterday. And that was Dragon Strike. It became a huge bestseller.
And tell us the story of Dragon Strike.
It's the story that many of us are reading in the newspapers every day. It's the rise of China, and are they going to take Taiwan, or what's happening in the South China Sea where they've built military bases on what were islands and that sort of thing. But it's 25 years ago.
And what was the response like to this in America and in China?
The Americans loved it. They loved it here. And the Chinese loved it too.
Wow. That's incredible. You managed to achieve that.
Because it made them out to be strong. And the city loved it, because I had this weird idea in there, is that if you know when you're going to start a war and you know when you're going to finish it, you can actually make quite a lot of money on the stock market. And I went in Hong Kong, which is a money capital, I went around about five or six people. The first four didn't get it at all. They didn't understand it. And this is what happens a lot when you're a journalist and you're trying to find stuff out. Four blacks. And then one of them sat down. We got onto the floor. He drew graphs and he told me exactly how it would work, which companies they would bet on, which wouldn't. I talked to him about 20 years later. He said, you gave me some ideas on that. Whenever there's a catastrophe.
So we can blame you, the market, Humphrey, then.
Yes.
Blame you for putting ideas in their head. That's quite concerning.
Yeah.
So I'm going to talk to you about another of your books here, Security Breach. Tell us about this one.
Security Breach. It is my sort of Hollywood story in a way.
There's a good story behind this as well.
The story behind this was a book that I think I did around 2008 or 9. And it was basically a commercial thriller, but it had a female, what we call a kick-ass heroine in it, who begins writing a thing, goes through it doing it. And everybody loved it, and it was published in the States. And the agent says to me, Humphrey, this is great. We've got this call from Hollywood. They want $9 million and franchise the character. $9 million, quite a lot of money. So I sort of sat down. and then I learned from this that a Hollywood deal or a Hollywood conversation like that tends to begin on a Monday when everybody's coming off their cocaine-fueled weekends, and it ends on a Thursday. And I happened to be in filming somewhere for the BBC, and he said, are you able to go across to LA to talk to these people? I said, yeah, sure, for $9 million. So I sort of, and the plane tickets were done and everything like that, and then no more calls. And by Thursday afternoon, nothing had happened. Friday, I called him up, and I said, what's happening to this thing? He says, oh, yeah, that must have gone away. They haven't done anything about it. And this is how and having done a few of these option things with this, is that there's a whole bunch of people with a studio which will get very excited about something. It runs through the week, but they'll have 10 or 20 things they're excited in. One will make it through, the rest of them just get forgotten.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, tell us about the story of Security Breach.
Security Breach is it's about... I mean, the reason that this one got forgotten, which is, and I've got to mention, is that I heard about 6 months later that the people that were going to go for this went for a book that we might have heard of called The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Vaguely know the name,
yeah. A kick-ass heroine, but slightly more kick-ass than mine. She walks, I mean, it begins, I can barely remember what is about it. She walks into an embassy in Washington, and everybody's dead. So somebody's been in there killing everybody, and then she has to, and then she leaves and she rescues her boss, who's a man, coming out, and then they go on the hunt for the bad guys. What was interesting is I ran it past a colleague of mine as I was doing it, a BBC colleague, and she said, "Ah, it's all very good, but you've got too much misogyny in there, Humphrey." And I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "Well, why don't you have her getting the men out of a bad situation instead of the men getting her out of a bad situation?" I said, "I can do that." I said, "That's easy." And that was my first bumping into what they now call unconscious bias. So I just switched it around. Yeah.
And this one is set in the Middle East in the US.
It's
what
set
made
in...
you choose that? Mm-hmm. What made you choose that part of the world?
Because I knew it. But it was mainly set in the US, actually.
Yeah.
And Central Asia. And I think I'd just been to Central Asia, so I sort of freshened the mind.
So you go to the US a lot. You do a lot of literary festivals and things there. Mm. Do they feel that you're really in their mindset? Because you seem to understand a huge amount about American security, spying, military.
Well, the period of time that I worked sort of a lot with the US was really the war on terror, the post 9/11 thing. And George W. Bush was in the White House. And what I found then was that every story we did, wherever it was in the world, needed a US voice from it, because they were the Roman Empire at the time. And what the US said went. And unlike now, where you actually have China and Russia, which are called state actors in the parlance, we were dealing then with non-state actors, so militia groups and that sort of thing. We're now again dealing with them because they're coming up. So I would, every time I would do a film or something like that, I would be in Washington talking to the people that have worked with the president or what were working with the president. And you sort of get a sense of how America operates. And it's very different to how we operate, because here in Britain, everything is secret. And as you found out, Lucinda, on the Royal Archives,
which we won't get into.
But in the US, the propensity is to make it open. So one of the first things I did was we filmed in a spy agency that was looking down at terror camps in Yemen, I think it was then, or Sudan or something like that. And the people are very open. And you would call them up and they would tell you things. And they have a very specific line there. So if you go into something called the RAND Corporation there, you have to put in what your security classification is. And everybody knows what is classified and what isn't classified. But here it's very murky, which is why when you're dealing with people from MI6 or MI5, retired people, and that, they're not quite sure what they can and they can't say. Because we have the Official Secrets Act and it come back and bite you at any time.
It's to me, it's really fascinating that you are revealing what seem to be kind of secrets in your books, and yet you're getting away with it and being adored in the US. I'm so impressed with it. Now, we're going to move to nonfiction. Asian Waters. This is such an interesting book. This came out, about 10 years ago, 8 years ago?
No, it came out about 5. That's an updated version. Right. So that came out about 3 years ago, okay. I think. Yes.
Tell us where this is, what it's about, because you mentioned this region earlier.
Yes, this was a lunch, actually, between my agent and the publisher, who was a guy called Peter Mayer, who was a legendary publisher in London. And he did Salman Rushdie's Satanic Verses, and he discovered Richard Adams from Watership Down. And he had a lunch, and this is going back to the old sort of lunch routine. I got a call from my agent, David Grossman, and he said, "Humphrey, you're knowledgeable about the South China Sea. Do you want to do a book on it?" And a bit like the meeting before, I said, "Yeah, sure." And it was actually very perceptive of the publisher. And he said, "Well, we're reading about China and we're reading about the militarizing the South China Sea, but we don't really know much about what is happening. We see it in the New York Times," he was saying. And I said to him, "But during the year or so that I was researching this book, it became clear that I had to cover the Indian Ocean, the South China Sea, the Pacific, and the whole lot, because it wasn't just that small area, which runs up from, those of you who might know your geography, runs up from Singapore and goes up through to Japan with the Philippines and Indonesia on that side and Thailand and Vietnam on the other. And what the Chinese have done is they've taken basically coral reefs that look like tropical islands if you're looking down at them. And they've reclaimed land there and built runways and missile bases and shelters and that sort of thing. So that any ship going through there now, it is like going through a strait because you've got Chinese guns on this side, Chinese guns on that side. And that happened mainly during the Obama administration. And it broke all sorts of international law. But that was what it's about. And then but it also looks at the other countries, because we're going to hear much more about Asia and the Indo-Pacific. Mm. We hear about it pretty much every day. So what is the connection between India and Japan? Why are India and Pakistan fighting so much? Why is Indonesia so big and so predominantly Muslim? I mean, we hear so little about it. And all of this, so it's sort of written as a read-through, but it's a primer. So if somebody, a businessman's going to Asia, they can pick it up and they can dip into it.
It's a really fascinating book. I read it a few years ago and I learned so much from it. I'm going to bring you back to some of your fiction now, because I'm very embroiled in these at the moment. So these are the first two of your, there's four so far, aren't there?
Yes.
Are you going to write more though?
Yes.
Good, excellent. The right answer. Right answer. So tell us about Rake Zenna.
Rake Zenna is a Alaskan native, and he lives on an outlying Alaskan island. And it's not just any old island, because I did a BBC story on this island just after the Crimea, Russia invaded Crimea. And I didn't know, and I'm not sure, I'd be really interested about how many people here know. I didn't know that, I knew that Russia and America had a border, sort of, you know, but you don't know much about it. But then when I looked on the atlas, I saw that there were two islands and the international date line goes through them. And one of the islands is called Big Diomede and the other one is called Little Diomede. And they are about 2 miles apart. One is a Russian military base and the other one is an Eskimo village, an American Eskimo village. And I thought, I've got to go there to film it. So I got permission from the tribal council. You have to charter a helicopter to get in. And there's about 80 people live there. No roads, no hotels, no restaurants, nothing. So I arrived and was given a space on the floor in the school to sleep. And it was meant to be a film about what's it like being an American living on the Russian border. And I don't know if you remember or I remember properly the presidential, vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin about 10 years ago.
Oh, yes.
Said Americans can see Russia from their backyard. Mm-hmm. And she was completely castigated and for not knowing anything. But she was right, because you walk out of somebody's home on Little Diomede and you're looking straight across at Russia. I was meant to be there for just an overnight, and then the helicopter was meant to come back, but the fog came down and I was there for 10 days. And what else do you do over a 10-day period, Lucinda, but write a thriller?
So the very first one, Man on Ice. Yeah.
Yes.
You got Man on Ice, we've got Man on Edge, Man on Fire. Yeah.
And then we ran out of men being respectably on anything.
So, and so...
Ice Islands.
Thank you, Ice Islands. So with Man on Ice, you have this scenario of an invasion. Tell us, actually, before we go there, what is the community like? And you use the word Eskimo, and I want you to set that kind of in context, because we're all kind of now told you can't use the word Eskimo. But in this, when you read Man on Ice, of course, it's a huge part of it. So tell us about that word, what it was like being there, and how you came up with this premise.
The Eskimo is, I was doing BBC work there, and we did some news pieces and from our own correspondent, which I wrote for a lot. And in that, I used the word Eskimo as quoting somebody. And we were out there actually on a boat with the villagers, and they are wonderfully rugged people that are very close to the land and the environment.
So they instinctively know that if a bird flies in a certain direction, the weather's going to do something like this. They know when the walruses and the seals are going to be out there and when they should go out onto the boats hunting. And they live right now, and I'm friends with them, so I see these pictures coming in every day. And the picture from yesterday, I mean, ice, snow, everything down there. Very, very rugged people. And we were out on a boat. I went in the summer. And I said to, it's an interesting border because there are no flags on either side. There's no border markings. There's no customs house. There's nothing to say that you're between these two nuclear superpowers. I think that's an agreement from way back. And I was saying to the somebody on the boat, I said, how come you don't have a flag? And he said, well, we know who we are. We don't need a flag. And I say, so you're a good, loyal American citizen. He said, no, I'm not an American. And I said, why do you think I'm an American? Supposing the Japanese buy us tomorrow, they'll want me to be Japanese. I said, well, what are you? He said, well, I'm an Eskimo from the Bering Strait Little Diomede. And they call themselves Eskimo. When I tried to tell this story to we worked for the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, they wouldn't use it because that word was considered to be derogatory. And actually, my BBC career, I found this many, many times, Lucinda, is that you're out there in the field and somebody will pronounce Smith as Smith, and then the local person will pronounce it Smythe, and you go back and say Smythe, and the BBC says, well, our pronunciation unit say it's Smith, so you better use Smith. Anyway, this Eskimo thing went right up to the top of the BBC. I think it even got to the Director General's office. And they came, and I had to play the tape of the guy saying it. And they came down and said, it's okay, you can use it.
Wow.
But when I was trying to find when you write a thriller, you've got to get your character for it. And you usually have this sort of either some drunk, dreadful guy who's resurrected or some ex-SAS person that's doing anything. And I went through all of this thing. And I thought, and then I sort of threw that out and thought how stupid I was being, because the people I was living with for 10 days or so, a lot of those have been fighting in Iraq under a thing called the Eskimo Scouts, which doesn't exist anymore, but they are the Eskimo Scouts, which is like the local special forces people for the Alaska National Guard. And I was talking to somebody from Alaska about them, and I said, what were they like, these Eskimo Scouts? He says, well, you've got these people called the Gurkhas, haven't you? And I said, yeah. He said, think of a Gurkha and then think 10 times, and that's how good a soldier they are. So I thought, he's the guy.
And Ray Kozena, who is your hero, I've got a couple of comments who've come in, actually. Jean says, I've read all the Ray Kozena books, loved them, but I'd never heard of the islands before. And Sue says, same as Jean, I'd never heard of this place until I read your books, which I loved. I've read the first two, looking forward to reading the remaining two. Well, remaining two, but there's more coming up, so don't worry. We're going to make Humphrey sit down after this and write a fifth one. But Ray Kozena.
We'll plot it afterwards,
yeah. Yes, exactly. So Ray Kozena is a brilliant hero, and it's very violent. I don't normally like violent books, but I was able to read this because you don't dwell too much on the violence, so you don't kind of find yourself going, oh no, I can't read
it. It's not cozy crime.
It's definitely not cozy crime. But Ray Kozena is a fascinating character. As you say, I mean, he makes Jack Reacher look like a bit of a weakling, really, which is not something I ever thought I'd say. How did you come up with who he was going to be? Did he just kind of appear in your mind as this person? Or did you have to do a backstory to him and work out, you know, his complicated childhood, the influences he had in his life, his physicality?
I think the main element, and I didn't know it was going to be a series, so the main element was in a thriller is to keep the pace going. And there's not a lot of time for reflection when you're one guy saving the world. But as I came to, because he flies in there with his fiancée, and his fiancée is from Brooklyn. So, you know, there's a sort of cultural thing there that to begin with. I found that writing through the four of them I've done now, and the fifth ones, the first thing is you put in his mind what he's going to do and why he's going to do it so that you understand what he's thinking. But then as you go on, you can actually explore a little bit about what he's feeling, why he's doing it. and what is and what are, as you say, his parentage. And I mean, one of the fascinating things about this society, I was there with a very talented young photographer who just sold a whole lot of stuff to the V&A, actually somebody called Palumi Basu, and she got very close to them. And we couldn't work out, as we got to know them over 10 days, who was married to who and whose was whose child. And there was a church there with a cross on it, and it looked like a sort of wooden version of a chapel or something that was completely empty, and they used it to store meat in. And I said, what's that church doing there? Nobody goes to. He says, oh, well, that was the missionaries. And I said, oh, well, what happened to them? None of you, you know, go to church. He says, no. He says, they didn't like our culture about looking after each other's wives. And I sort of did a little double take on that, but it completely made sense, because if you are a man going out maybe for 6 months in the winter to hunt walrus or whatever in the old days, then you would, you know, you would have somebody else look after your wife. And for them, it was not an issue at all. But for the missionaries, of course, it was a sin. So,
which leads to these highly complicated family relationships of
yes.
whose child or who's yeah. taking care yeah. of whose child, which is where Rake really has this sense of extended family to everyone on the island, really.
Yes, his mother vanished. His father was believed to be in Russia because he fell in love with a woman on the other island. But then the Iron Curtain, or they call it the Ice Curtain, came down. So he's believed to be somewhere Russian. He was raised by one of the few solid couples on the island who are actually people who I'm Facebook friends with.
And they're wonderful. Are they real people?
Well, they're not real, but they're based on a couple there, yes. Yeah.
They are yeah. a fantastic
couple. And I won't
couple.
Say who they are at the nope. moment, because you have put that thing yeah. at the beginning of books that yeah. everybody's fictitious.
So we've got Rake, and then we've got Carrie. You mentioned her briefly, Rake's fiance in this book. And tell us about her, because she's a great character. And I would say, as a female reader, a very, very believable female character.
So my misogyny's gone.
Your misogyny's gone, yeah. So Carrie is a trauma surgeon.
Yes.
And I'm fascinated. You obviously know a huge amount about what it would be like to be a trauma surgeon. How did you research that? Because I learned loads about the life of a trauma surgeon reading your books.
Yes, they have a thing that I'm a member of, founding member of something called the International Thriller Writers Association. And when I was on my way to do this story, I dropped by their annual conference, and there happened to be a trauma surgeon who was trying to write a medical thriller. And I said, I'll swap you. Can I run my stuff past you on this and you run your book past me? And she said, yeah. I'll do that. So I would say, look, this is happening. I know it's all wrong, but make it right for me, which is the way I do it. And she went into great detail and a great lot of trouble. So, you know, as you say, all mistakes are my own. But I hope it's pretty. And they met when Rake was being deployed to Afghanistan. Carrie was in Afghanistan, and there was a car bomb, and they met. They met there.
Yeah. And it's a great idea for a character, because most people going into the world that Rake inhabits would be completely freaked out and suffer from PTSD instantly. Mm. But of course, she's used to it, because yes. she's worked in Afghanistan as a trauma surgeon. So it's a really great idea for a character to be in that world. And tell us about Steph, one of your other characters, Stephanie.
Stephanie is the, in that one, she's the British ambassador to the US. And then in the other one, she changes. I think she's the British ambassador to Moscow, and then she becomes foreign secretary, and mm-hmm. she becomes a baroness and everything like that. But she was raised in a South London dodgy used car lot by a single father. And the single father taught her how to rig odometers and fix brakes and all that sort of thing. And she took that skill to the London School of Economics, and then she took it into diplomacy. So you can lie or cheat for your used car salesman, and she goes out and lies and cheats for her country. But she does it in a brilliant way, yes.
So you go into British politics, American politics, Russian politics, obviously Alaska itself. What do they all feel about you in these different countries? I mean, does Russia like you, ban you? What about America now with these?
The Russians I know, not the Russian government, I haven't spoken to about it. The Americans love it. I mean, they like it, and they also like the fact that there's a minority hero in it, which wasn't my intention at all, because he's the right man to do the job. And there's the cross-cultural relationship between him and Carrie. And they love the Brits. There's a scene, not in this one, of in Checkers and that sort of mm-hmm. thing, when they see the Prime Minister. So, and what I try to do, and I, goodness knows if you're successful, is you try to drip a bit of something into it that people don't know, like these two islands, mm-hmm. but don't stop the pace of the story. So don't let anything get in the way of the pace, but you can finish and say, oh, I never knew about, like those comments
yeah,
that came in, I never knew about this border.
I never knew about it before I saw you writing about it for the BBC and posting on Facebook yeah. about where yeah. you'd been, and I was fascinated
yes.
by it.
Yes.
I was really glad, actually, that it led to these books.
Yes, and there was one I did call The Man on Fire, which is about something called electromagnetic pulse. And I did quite a lot of research on that, and there's this sort of thing up there that can stop all our Wi-Fi happening and our cars going and everything like that. And I talked to Oliver Letwin, who used to be a British cabinet minister, and a few people, including James Arbuthnot, who's become quite famous on the post office thing. And these guys in the sort of background of government know completely about the risks that we live in on this. And the Americans, as I said before, they were much more open and they gave me graphs and chapter and verses and that sort of thing. And I've just noticed in the past couple of months, there was something came out that said we should always have a torch or we should have a battery radio or something like that. So, mm-hmm. so it's sort of...
Yeah. We're all going to need an Anderson shelter again
soon. Yeah, we should.
Yeah. A dehydrated food. And yeah. Except there won't be any water to rehydrate it, so that's probably not a great idea.
That's for sure, yes. Yeah.
So when you're writing these, what's your writing process?
Dreadful. Absolutely. I mean, I love it when somebody says, well, I get up at 6 and I write until 10 and then I go for a run and then I do... No, because I do so many other things. That it's really, there was one of them I was doing, and I was writing the final chapter of the book in transit at Dubai Airport. And I thought, this isn't really, you know, what you
hear writers
doing.
Exactly what you should be doing.
Yes, you should. And your mind, of course, is on this other thing, and then you have to wrench it back and put it up on that thing. So I do it as and when I can, and I need a deadline.
Mm.
Because if the publisher says we'll do it whenever, it probably
it's never going to get done.
Never get done. But partly for being a journalist, particularly working for the BBC, where if something happens, you have to be on air like within a minute of it happening, and you have to have done your dispatch within certainly 30 minutes and broadcast it. I can say to myself, look, for the next hour, I'm going to do this and something will come out of the end of the tube. It might be rubbish, but at least mm-hmm. something comes out.
Well, let's go back to your BBC career. And one of the things of which I'm most proud of you for doing, and I hope you're proud as well, is the slavery in the chocolate industry campaign. So can you talk us through that? Tell us what actually happened in the chocolate industry and how you exposed this and what's still happening.
It was around 2000. And I was in West Africa doing a story about something else. I think it was about democracy in Ghana, actually. And they just had a transition of democracy. But I went to an NGO, a charity, Save the Children, and they said, you really should do a story about this. And they showed me a sort of classroom of children that had been rescued from cocoa plantations. I didn't know at the time that most of our chocolate or cocoa comes from West Africa. The Ivory Coast, particularly. And I said, well, what do you mean they've been rescued? He says, well, they're sold there and they are enslaved. And they showed me people who did kids. He was about 12 and he had been kept in handcuffs or ropes in a sort of hut. And he had tried to escape. So they had slashed his feet so that he couldn't run anymore. But he could use a machete to cut the cocoa beans. And I thought, well, this is a bit off.
So I went, understatement. Yeah.
I went back to London and I said, we should look into this story. And nobody was quite convinced, but I said, I'll look into it a bit more. And I went to Mars and Cadbury and the chocolate companies. And I said, I've just got this thing. They said, no, it's absolute rubbish. He said, everything's not like that. So I went back and with the Save the Children, we drove through Mali, into the Ivory Coast and right up what they call the Cocoa Belt, and we found dozens of these people. You could just walk onto what they call a plantation. It's basically a little patch of bush, really, with these cocoa plants on there. And there were kids that were cutting, and because they cut, they would cut their things and cut that. And it was quite easy to tell what was legal and what wasn't legal, because if you were there on Tuesday at 11 o'clock, they should be at school. Mm-hmm. And they weren't. And the chocolate company said, oh, no, they're just helping their families during the harvest like we do in Britain. Rubbish.
Yeah.
And I went back again and we got a little stronger with the chocolate companies. And they wouldn't speak to us individually. They said, no, we talk as an organisation. I think it was called the confectionery industry. And then a letter comes through, this copy to me, to the BBC Director General, who was Greg Dyke at the time, as saying that they should stop their reporters fabricating stories and that I needed to be fired and all the rest of it. The BBC, given its due, said, OK, right, you were obviously onto something here, go for it. And then there was a time, then a ship was actually transporting these children across, and it became quite a big story because somebody rammed into it or something. And we had a lot of footage from what I had done and the ship story, which was headlines. We ran with that. And then the American, two American politicians went and said, right, we're going to legislate against this. Nothing in Britain. British politicians not interested. And they put something out called the Harkin-Engel Protocol, which basically all the chocolate companies signed to say that they were going to end this within 5 years or something like that. I went back about 10 years later and nothing had changed.
So shocking.
I went
shocking.
Back to Washington to talk to Elliot Engel, who was one of the guys that put it, and showed him the photographs. He was absolutely furious. He said, fool me once, fool me twice, but they will not fool me this time. He was furious that they hadn't done it. And then he used our thing as evidence. But the latest report out is that there are more children in slavery now in the chocolate industry than there were when I went there. And I had one of the big companies I had a lunch with, the PR guy, they would keep saying they're going to write it, and they took me out to lunch. And I said, what happens when something like this comes through, that this protocol that you all sign and you're meant to do? He says, oh, well, we sign it and then we give it a few months and then we put it in the bin.
Wow.
I think I'd given him a glass too much wine, but it was worth it.
Did you have it recorded? As in,
no, I didn't.
What a pity. But a great soundbite to put on Twitter.
Probably. I don't think Twitter was around. But yeah, and it's still. And then after that, I was the BBC's go-to guy to do these, what they call supply chain stories, human rights and supply chain. So we found this similar thing, not quite as bad, in the cotton industry in India, sugar in Guatemala, bricks in India that's building all that. And it's just, you know, you think Marks and Spencers are buying this stuff and they say they're doing it right, but actually, you know, the only place that seems to have sort of is Bangladesh.
Right.
Yeah, and China. And in those ones, they actually have gone right in there at the bottom and made sure that, I think the shirt could be a Bangladesh shirt, that people are well paid or paid enough. But India is not great.
And so people now are obsessed with, oh, it's made in China, therefore it's bad. And actually what you're saying is that if it's made in China, that the human rights are better.
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole different conversation we won't get into.
Right.
But the human rights is a sort of, depends who you are, you know, and where you are. Yeah. And if you're in China and your train works and your electricity works, but you don't have a vote, is that better than being in India where you don't have a home, you don't have a toilet and that sort of thing? Yeah.
So going back to the chocolate, what can we do? I mean, because as you said, you went back and it was worse than it had been before you started this campaign. What can we do as just people who might be consumers of chocolate or who could write to the companies? Is that what we should do? Should we lobby the government? Should we get Toby Jones to go on TV and be chocolate manufacturer? I mean, what can we do?
Well, your passion, I mean, I'm going to quiz you about that in a minute. Your passion is fantastic, but, and I'm a little jaded, and I think we're all familiar with the post office scandal now, and that is that you can not buy the chocolate and you can write to your MP and you can do that, but it's not going to do an inkling of any good. So if you enjoy...
Such a depressing thought, Humphrey,
yeah,
really?
Yeah, it's really not.
Wow.
And since I started on the chocolate thing, they've had United Nations guidelines coming through. They've had numerous laws in the US coming through. And the big companies, Cargill is the big sort of intermediary company, they find ways around it. And of course, you know, they lobby, they get their PR companies, they do all sorts of things. So you can, but I think be aware of it. And when you're talking to, if you bump into somebody from Cadbury's or over Easter, just mention it.
So tell us about your response when you asked someone from Cadbury.
Because they had, as I said, they had this overarching thing. I think it was the Confectionery Association. So they would put out a statement, but you couldn't talk to Mars and you couldn't talk to Cadbury's and you couldn't talk to those sort of things. And it was when the ship was coming in that I said to the Cadbury guy, I said, you have got to speak about this. Cadbury's is a Quaker organization founded on basic, decent values, and you cannot be using slavery in order to make your profits. He didn't answer then, but the next day he gave me a personal statement as him as spokesman, and then he resigned from the company. And I think that actually began to crack the whole thing.
And have you ever gone back to Cadbury since and tried to find out if his resignation changed anything within the company?
Well, it's sort of that, I mean, that, what happens, and a lot of this is happens not just in this industry, but what tends to happen is that these companies will put X million into setting up a foundation, and that foundation will go out to West Africa. And it doesn't actually address the problem. It'll build a school or something like that and then say that it's done it. And when I was going more deeply into this talking about social responsibility, some companies in all of these things would have a social responsibility person on their board, but that person had no power.
Mm.
And that basically it was about profits and dividends for shareholders. And that was where they thought their values were in delivering those dividends for shareholders.
We've got lots and lots of comments coming in about this, mostly saying thank you and what amazing work you're doing. We've got a question here. Is fair trade chocolate produced like this?
Yes and no. You will go in, and I've been there, and you can go through these plantations and you'll see something that's, and I won't name any names, a sort of billboard up there saying, you know, certified by X thing for fair trade, and then see the children cutting the stuff. So they go in and then, you know, everybody clears it out for a day or a month or whatever, and then they go back to doing what they naturally do.
So in all good faith, the fair trade chocolate providers are thinking,
yes,
that they're creating it without slave,
yes,
labour, but actually they're being lied to by
the chocolate. Well, they're not doing the due diligence properly. They're not going deep enough into it properly. And I'll just say something, you were talking about the human rights issue before, is that up until the early 90s, the Ivory Coast was a dictatorship by a mad ruler who built the biggest cathedral in the world outside of St. Petersburg and that sort of thing. But what he did is that he guaranteed the farmers enough money to live on and to build a house and to educate their children under the dictatorship. When that left, and we all thought that democracy was going to run the world, the free marketeers came in and said, no, you only can get paid for your cocoa what it's worth on the open market. And of course, the price dropped and they didn't make the money. And they wouldn't make the roads up going to the farms so that the middlemen particularly were the only people that had the vehicles that could go through those roads. So they had a price.
Wow.
So they couldn't do that. So there's a whole tangled web that I've uncovered that, and lots of other people uncovered too, that is just part and parcel of life, I guess.
So it's not really surprising you went into writing fiction, because quite frankly, when you're spending your life desperately trying to bring about change and it's just not happening, I'm not surprised you thought, right, I'm going to write a book where, you know, good wins out in the end.
Yeah. But I just want to reverse the tables, if I might, Lucinda.
We've got about 5 minutes, so yeah.
Second, yeah. But you, as your bloodline from Charles Dickens, have written some pretty good campaigning books as well, like March, Women, March, about the suffrage. You're very good on whether I'm a misogynist or not. You're going to be my misogynist. So tell us, is that a bloodline thing or a passion that you have?
Well, it's a passion, but perhaps that comes down the bloodline. I mean, I, as you do, get very, very kind of agitated by injustice. And I think since school days, I mean, very much so. One thing I'm most proud of about Dickens is how much he really did manage to change the world, and perhaps something that present-day journalists like yourself must find frustrating that they don't have quite as much sway.
How did he
as
change
he had.
It? Give us
he
an example.
Did, yes. So he, for example, when he wrote Nicholas Nickleby, he wrote about these things called the Yorkshire schools, which were real schools that unwanted children were sent to. And they were in Yorkshire, which pre the railways, very inaccessible. Once a child was sent there, they couldn't escape. And it was where you could send your unwanted stepchildren, perhaps, or a, you know, an illegitimate child, or a disabled child, because disability rights were just non-existent in the 19th century. Dickens heard about this when he was a court reporter, before he became a novelist. And he knew that they were still going on, despite prosecutions. And so he went to Yorkshire and he went undercover, although the main person he wanted to interview, he was already fairly famous by then, discovered who he was and didn't give him an interview. But they posed as friends of a widow who'd been left with sons, who wanted to educate her sons. And he wrote very proudly that within 2 years of Nicholas Nickleby coming out, in which his main character, Nicholas, becomes a teacher at one of these schools and leads a rebellion, and it's a great uprising of the boys. He said that within 2 years of Nicholas Nickleby being published, every one of those Yorkshire schools had been closed down, because when he wrote the novel, other journalists thought, well, do you think this is true? And they went to Yorkshire and they saw the same graveyards that Dickens and his illustrator had seen, of lots of young boys in graves, sometimes four of them on the same gravestone. And they started to write about the iniquity of these schools. He did a lot of campaigning for the rights of mothers, the estranged mothers to see their children, all of those kind of things that were big topics at the time that he often knew the campaigners. They would tell him, and he would put it either in his books or in his journalism. He set up two magazines. He investigated in mining disasters where children were used. He was really hot on particularly injustices against children and against the poorest people.
So when you said that the Nicholas and Prue was a novel, it reminds me of the post office saga that was reported by journalists.
Yes, journalists tried their
Everybody
hardest.
Knew about it, but it wasn't until it was semi-dramatized that anybody took any notice.
Absolutely. And I think this is something that Dickens managed really well long before television, was to serialize his novels that came out every week or every month, like a kind of soap opera that people absolutely loved. But he included the really important issues of the day. So, for example, in Oliver Twist, the first person who wants to take Oliver from the workhouse when they're desperate to get rid of him, and they're giving away a child plus £5 to anyone who'll take this child. I mean, the safeguarding implications are horrifying.
What year are we talking
about? 1837. And the first person who wants him is a chimney sweep. And Dickens mentions, just very, almost as an aside, he'd already bruised to death four children. Bruised to death, as if it's not really that bad. And this is what he was saying to his readers. Every time you have a chimney sweep in your house, you probably don't see it because your butler lets them in or your housekeeper sorts it out. They're sending children up that chimney.
Now, what about you with your bloodline? What are you going to write your next campaigning novel or non-fiction book on to change the world?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I think actually the new misogyny is something that's really frightening. I think the world is definitely changing. I mean, I feel as if...
The new misogyny. My misogyny.
No, not yours. Yeah. No, the way that social media has allowed such incredible trolling. You know it with female broadcasters, how they get much more grief than male broadcasters. The language has really slipped back. I think when I was at university in the 90s, it was a kind of halcyon time where we were very equal. I see my niece's university days utterly different. The way that social media is encouraging a new hatred.
And would you do this as a novel or as non-fiction?
Possibly as a novel, yeah. I think there's a definite change in my attitude towards writing. I love writing non-fiction. I'd like to keep writing non-fiction, but I'm definitely working towards fiction.
The new misogyny.
At the moment. Yeah.
We're going to watch out for that.
And I think we're just at the end of our time here. This has been so amazing. We've got loads of comments coming in and lots of people saying how much they've enjoyed it, and those of you who've already read your books and who are now going to read them. So tell us the name of the latest one is Ice Islands, am I right?
Ice Islands is the latest one, and that is set in Japan. Again, the tiny little thing that I didn't know is that Russia and Japan are technically still at war and that they only had a ceasefire. They don't have a peace treaty. And there are disputed islands that run between Sakhalin and Hokkaido, which is the northern island there. And also it's looking at Japanese nationalism and whether there's a resurgence of it. And Ray Kazena's in the middle of it again.
He gets around, doesn't he?
And he and Carrie have a row, I think. They almost split up because they don't work that well together because they're both sort of, you know,
Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton of the literary
world.
Yes,
something like that is in there.
I could talk to you about this for hours and hours. Thank you so much to everyone who's joined us and to everybody here at the beautiful Riverstone Living in London in Fulham. Just to say thank you, Humphrey. This has been wonderful. We've had such a great time working together on the Goldster Book Club, and this feels a really fantastic
thing to have done. It's been fantastic, yeah. No, thanks. This is very special. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Just before we leave the recording, I think we might just have quick time to tell everyone what's coming up on Goldster. You've got somebody tomorrow?
I have got tomorrow Tim Bale, who's a professor of politics, and he is going to be telling us about how British politics works. And I talked to him just before I came here. I said, Tim, I don't really understand it. And he said, well, I said, where should we start? And I said, can you tell us firstly what a democracy is? And he said, goodness, that's a question. I said, and when did Britain become a democracy? He said, 1929. Does that ring a bell with anybody? I mean, I'm not saying you're all that old, but I'm just saying it didn't ring a bell with me. Anyway, we're going to go through how the parties were formed and what it meant and why Churchill was kicked out of power. Not just the landslide. He had won the war. And even before Japan was defeated, they kicked him out in a landslide. What does that say about Britain? So, yeah, we're going to go through all of that stuff. And we're not going to be political. We're not going to take sides. We're just going to tell everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fascinating. And then on Tuesday, Rosie Stancer is back talking to Benedict Allen, Part 2, The Explorer. It'll be absolutely fascinating. I'm sure many of you tuned in for the first part, and it's going to be absolutely wonderful. Also, the first part is on catch-up if you want to watch it. And I will be back next Thursday talking to Jean Briggs, who is it president of the Crime Writers Association?
She's on the committee.
She's on the committee of the Crime Writers Association, and she's written a series of great crime writing books with Dickens as a detective. Very appropriate.
And the bursary.
Doing that. And there's also, which you must look on the Goldster website or on the Crime Writers Association website, there is a Goldster bursary for crime writers with Red Herrings. It's in Red Herrings magazine.
Goldster, we're giving a year's bursary for a crime writer or wannabe crime writer. And because we're all living such long, beautiful lives now, we're putting the age from age 55 to 121. Anybody can apply for it.
And what will Ray Kazena be doing at 121?
He'll be president of the world,
you know,
I would think.
It'd be quite good, but I think he needs to just curb his tendencies to just suddenly punch people occasionally.
Yeah, well, some people need to be punched.
On that note, we're definitely ending. Thank you so much, everybody. That was really great, Humphrey. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this Goldster podcast, where we aim to bring you great interviews, to expand your world, and to keep you curious. Please look us up at www.goldster.co.uk. That's Goldster spelt G-O-L-D-S-T-E-R. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast.